Hey everybody, just Dave and I this week with Shop Talk Show number 275. We're going to be talking about all kinds of fun stuff. We're going to talk about Parallax, Webpack, teaching your 11-year-old daughter, Flash, why not, splitting up your style sheets during development, all kinds of great stuff. It's brought to you by this week's CSS DevConf. That's CSSDevConf.com coming up October 9th through 11th in New Orleans. Both Dave and I will be there. We'll tell you more about that later in the show, but for now, Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about websites and stuff, and you know it. I'm Dave Rupert with Chris Coyer, and we're going to talk about websites.
It got a little Mario Brothers-y there, didn't it?
Did it? Oh, no copyright infringement intended. I was just riffing.
I wonder what the title of that song is. Do you think it's the Mario Brothers theme song, or do you think it has a cool name?
I bet it's like Mario in C minor major 7. It's got an Italian name.
What a classic.
Mario's Italian.
Still fun.
Yes. Hey, Chris, we are here in the Shop Talk Show studios talking about websites. What's going on today?
We have some questions that y'all sent in. Keep doing that. Thanks very much. And we just handpicked a few, you know, sometimes just depending on my mood, I'm like, that one looks interesting. So that's what we'll do. This one is, from M. Karimifar. Thanks for sending in a question. M, who says, I'm taking on a parallax project. You know all what I mean, right? You scroll down the page and different things move at different speeds. Kind of a fun effect, can be done performantly. The trick being don't make scrolling hard, but making scrolling fun is cool. I don't know. Let's not talk about the ins and outs of parallax. M has a different question here. I'm taking on a parallax project with a long story full of SVG graphics and text. Do you have any recommendations on how to prepare the SVG code in Illustrator? Do you recommend other software? Is it easier to include text in SVG when working with graphics? Is it easier to have all of the graphics in one artboard for the weird coordinates that Illustrator has, etc.? So I think M just wants us to talk about like an approach there or some thoughts about that wide world.
Oh, boy. You would probably be the expert.
Well, I don't know about that.
Can we call Sarah Dresser? Can I use a lifeline?
Phone a friend.
Phone a friend, go call Sarah. Let's see. You're going to have to do classic PSD, like name your layers really well.
That's one of the first things I thought of too. But although maybe even widening out from that a little bit, you're probably not going to be able to make one SVG graphic that is the entire page here, because an SVG element, as far as I know, can't really scroll. You know, like you can't like make an SVG that's 10, 20,000 pixels tall or whatever. And it like, you know, like if you position something outside of the SVG, you know, viewport and view box or whatever, it just is gone. It's not, you can't like scroll an SVG element. Either that or there's something weird there that confuses me. So it's not like you'd open up Illustrator and like design your entire page top to bottom that way. Or you could, but that's just going to be a reference for what you're going to ultimately build in HTML, you know? So like I would think of this as like, let's not, like if we're going to do this in Illustrator, let's make one document that maybe is like a draft of how this thing is going to look ultimately. But that's not, I don't know that that's necessarily the complete, like you might want to design your assets kind of separately, or don't think like, okay, I'm done in Illustrator, I just want to hit export and get something useful out of it. You're definitely going to be re-piecing this thing back together.
And you're going to do quite a bit of like sanitizing too. You know, when you copy paste an SVG from Illustrator, and by that I mean you select the things you want, copy it, and then paste it into HTML.
You get some cruft, you know, you get some weird ID names, you get some weird like classes like ST0, ST1, ST2.
Sure, yeah. I don't know if that's like recommended for your daily use. I think about this stuff regularly. There's a lot of ways to get SVG out of Illustrator. There certainly is copy and paste, and I can see how that would be really desirable when you're referencing an Illustrator document and moving it over to HTML. You're like, oh, wow, I can just hit Command C and Command V and get that code out of there like I need. I don't know what like internal engine it uses to do that, but I don't think that's your best bet as far as like export of SVG out of there. Like what view box are you going to get? I don't know. Very bizarre. There's, you know, in modern Illustrator, there's an asset export panel, you know, just like your layers panel and your colors panel and all that stuff. There's an asset export panel. So you can like grab any object or group of objects or whatever and just drag it on there. And then it's like that little chunk is ready to be exported. It's a little bit like Sketch on how any you can say make exportable on any layer in Sketch. And then that little thing can kind of export itself. I really like that. I know that when you export something from Illustrator in that way, that it is actually pretty darn clean. It's like you might still get a little love out of SVGO or whatever, but it comes out pretty good, pretty cruft-free. So I would recommend probably doing it that way. Like you have this big layout and all the little individual assets that you intend to be little chunks of SVG, you put in the asset export panel and export that way. There's also save as SVG. There's also save for web, which works with SVG. There's also the, you know, save layers, save artboards as SVG. There's export as SVG. There's like 8 ways to get SVG out of Illustrator, and it's very confusing, I think. So,
hey, you want an SVG? I got 8 ways. 8 ways to get you an SVG.
Best bet, probably that asset export panel, I would say, in this situation.
Yeah. You know, I think, I think that'll get your SVG out. You know, there's 100 ways, and you'll probably do it wrong the first way. But I know we did like kind of a complex animation with SVG, never shipped, womp womp, but it was, had to do a lot of like, you know, putting it back into HTML. We were just using CodePen at the time. So we'd like put it into CodePen and then we'd like have to like, oh shoot, something's messed up. So we'd take it back into Illustrator. Oh shoot, something's messed up. You know, like it just kind of, it was a bit of a song and dance because as good as Illustrator is, it's not a web engine, you know? And so you know, it doesn't really do the animations. So anytime you kind of start trying to manipulate it, you kind of have to do it back and forth. So I did, it wasn't panacea, but it is the same technology, but you know, you kind of like the main thing is view boxes and artboard sizes and all that is just, it's kind of just black magic. You know, it
feel like that's another thing is that asset export panel that I was just saying how useful it is probably. Cause that way it's like, I can imagine that, you know, now you have like an assets folder, perhaps with this whole web project that you're working on. That's like, you know, mountain background.svg and like call out blurb.svg. And, you know, I don't know, all these individual assets, at least then it's like, oh, something screwed up. Let me just pop over to the Illustrator document, make some tweaks to that particular asset and resave it and see if that fixed it. And, you know, I don't know. It's like, that seems like a good workflow, which seems to be important in this complicated thing. That asset export panel really doesn't allow you to have any input at all in what that view box is going to be. You want some white space around the thing? Too bad. You're not getting it. There's literally no way to do it unless you put like a white rectangle object behind it. And now you have a white rectangle that you didn't want. I guess it could be transparent, but still it's like, I don't want a rectangle there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. Cause Illustrator doesn't, you know, clip, or I guess you can throw things off of the artboard, but you know, you put it into the web document and then you're like, oh, I want this thing to be a little smaller. And then like now it's just ruined. Now it can't just make things a little smaller. But he asked about text, Chris. Do you have opinions on this?
Yeah, that was interesting to me too. I'm sure you have thoughts on that. You can put, there's all these different ways of putting text in SVG. One of the ways that's somewhat common is just to treat it in a way like a JPEG, like make sure that just convert it to outlines and treat the text as like you would any other arbitrary drawing object in SVG, like vector paths are drawing it. That's fine, kind of. It's just the text is usually pretty intricate, and it's going to blow up the file size of that SVG. So if it's a lot of text, you're looking at all of a sudden this SVG ballooning up in size. SVG has a literal TEXT element in it, which is just like web text, and that's really the way to go if you can use it, because it's like it's selectable, it's SEO friendly, it's searchable on the page, it's accessible, it's all those like great things. It's just like a P tag sitting anywhere else. It's just that you've positioned it exactly where it needs to go, and all that, has all the SVG abilities too. It's really wonderful, but also very limited. It can't wrap, for example. So if in this Parallax project, you have a paragraph of text that's about the mountaineering shoes that you're trying to sell or whatever, I don't know if I would set that in SVG, knowing that the text can't really wrap and that it's the sizing in SVG is so bizarre and stuff. If it was a headline or something and you wanted to control where it wrapped, you kind of thought of it as a typographic lockup, absolutely set that in SVG TEXT elements, and Illustrator will export that way. It gives you a little drop-down option that's like, what do you want me to do with the type? Do you want me to convert it to outlines for you? Do you want me to leave it alone? And you should say leave it alone. And what's cool about that is it can even use the web fonts that you're using in the document itself. It will happily set that type in, Proxima Nova or whatever you're using. So that's cool. But yeah, body type, probably not the best solution there for an SVG.
Yeah, you stole the words out of my mouth. If you have like a cool, headline lockup or kind of just intricate text lockup, maybe convert that to outlines. Or if you're using a font one-off, some just like really complex font, Bleeding Cowboy.
Good example. Sure.
Actually, that would be terrible to convert to SVG because it would have so many points. But
this would be really weird. But if you needed to be in that SVG context, you could output a somewhat high-res version of it raster and place the raster graphic within the SVG. I know that sounds insane, but it's like it's outlines anyway. So
yeah, well, I guess I was just saying if you like, you can do outlines like if it's kind of like a one-off font or if it's kind of like a super intricate text lockup where, the CSS or the text element positioning is kind of just getting silly, maybe just do the outlines. But any kind of paragraphy text, I would use the text node, like TEXT ... or whatever.
I like it. A lot of advice here. Yeah. We started off by saying, get a workflow going, because you're going to need, this sounds like it's going to be somewhat of a complex project. Don't just like jump into it and start writing code here and designing over here and whatever. You might have to a little bit to experiment at first, but get to a point where you're happy with how changes can be made in a happy way. Do all the naming, do all the organizing. Just be very organized about this and you should be okay.
And, SVG, you need like an assembly line. Like, how do I get SVG to HTML? How do I get SVG to CSS? And you need like that assembly line kind of built out. And if anyone wants to write a blog post called SVG to HTML assembly line, I that sounds really good about your assembly line. But I think when did we go to CSS DevConf on the boat, Chris? I kind of blacked out, so I may not remember it exactly. 2013-y? I feel like I had a kid. 2015?
No way. It was literally last year, wasn't it? Or no?
2015, because okay. I just had a baby. And so 2015... We heard a whole bunch of SVG talks and it was just very clear, like SVG is almost its own thing. Like it's alternate reality HTML. So like you can go really, really deep on it. And, hopefully somebody's written some books on SVG, I don't know. Maybe a
for sale really now.
Practical
Google practical SVG. Yes. Thank you very much. That's nice. Yeah, you're right. It was in San Antonio last year and then the year before it was on the boat.
I don't know why.
New Orleans this year, 2017. Both Dave and me this year.
we'll be there.
Hey, hey, everybody. Time to come to New Orleans. CSS DevConf, that's cssdevconf.com, is an in-person conference. It's been in New Orleans before. It's coming to New Orleans again. That is October 9th through 11th. So get your planning on right now and come there. I'll be there. Dave's going to be there. Dave's given one of the keynote presentations along with Harry Roberts and Mina Markham. It's going to be great. Those are, you know, there's 2 days, October 9th and 10th, of community chosen sessions. So there's tons of voting and all that. And all the best of those sessions are being presented through those days, along with the keynotes. And we're doing a code pen show and tell. And there's just a tons of going on. Everybody's talking about web design and CSS. And it's just the greatest conference. I've been to all of them. I love them. So that's coming up October 9th through 11th, the last day of the 11th. There's workshops, and I'll be giving one of those as well. So if you want to come to mine and talk about front-end design and development like all day long, that's going to be awesome, about the job of front-end development. But there's also a design system ones. There's a React one. There's a web animations one. Go to the one that makes sense for you. Super long session where you just deep dive into some stuff after your brain is already full and raring to go from those first 2 days. It's just going to be so much fun. And it's in the French Quarter of New Orleans. You know, make a week out of it. Come early, stay late, do what you're going to do. Oh, it's going to be fantastic. Again, Dave and I are going to be there. Again, cssdevconf.com. Again, October 9th through 11th. We'll see you there.
All right. Vadim Hrachov.
Nice.
Nailed it. We almost, to the listener, a little peek behind the curtain here, we almost did an episode where we picked all the hard to pronounce last names just for our sake. That would be
a theme show, as it were.
A theme show, hard last names. So all right, Vadim writes in, thank you for podcast. My question is about Webpack. Can you please give me your thoughts about it? I'm trying to understand it, watch tutorials, but I feel like some kind of reinventing the wheel. For example, I'm using Browserify, I'm using static site generator HarpJS, and all this tool provides is very similar functionality.
I do have some thoughts, but I'll let you go first on the, are you shipping anything with Webpack?
No, not unless I had to.
Yeah.
not unless I have a React app or something. I might use Webpack here on a thing I'm making, just because I hit the pull it up in old iOS and old IE threshold, and now my JavaScript doesn't work in those browsers. So I'm like, darn it, I'm gonna have to Babel, and I needed to bundle them together anyway. Mm-hmm. So I'm probably gonna have to Webpack. I think Webpack is good for those two things. Bundling and transpiling. Is that?
Yeah, but it's not Webpack that's doing the transpiling. It's Babel, but it fits in the same workflow pretty well.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'll call them siblings. I think if you have a workflow, I think it's probably good. There's probably nuance and things where Browserify is maybe not as good as Webpack, or vice versa, or it does something weird for the dependency injection. I know Nolan Lawson has written a bunch of exhaustive posts on that, about like who does what and what is compiling to what. So I can link that up. I'll put a link in the show notes to Nolan Lawson's blog, but I would not get hung up on that. I think here's my new 2017 mantra. You ready, Chris? I know everyone was waiting for a mantra.
Shop Talk Show laws.
Here's a new law, Shop Talk Show law. If it looks useful to you, it probably is. Does that sound good?
I like that. Sure.
Just like,
because there's so many things that don't look useful to you. Like, you know, you follow some link, somebody tweets some link, and you're like, oh, that looks like they care about that thing, or they're vaguely excited about it. Let me click and look at it. I don't get it. Like, immediately I'm like, So like, and that happens to me 90% of the time. Often I'll look up and down and try and wrap my head around at least what it is. But usually I'm not like immediately like, ooh, that looks useful to me. But if it does, it probably is.
I like, yeah. I think, you know, if it looks useful immediately, it probably solves your problem. The thing we need as a community to be careful about is just the hype cycle, you know, like, oh, this looks useful to West Boss, so therefore it's useful to me, you know, and I should just require it in my project. I'm not picking on West, who has a really great podcast, by the way, you should check it out. But, I think we need to be careful to not just kind of, you know, hive mind onto things, you know. I think you just, and not, don't feel like you're missing out. I think you need to kind of like check things out and
sure,
sort of like, if it's not useful, it's maybe not useful at the moment. So
we can dig into this a little bit more though. The Vadim says for straight up, he's using Browserify right now. The way Browserify works, 99% sure, is that it's for bundling JavaScript, but it does it kind of node style, and that you use require statements. Require parenthesis parenthesis. Yeah. Require isn't a thing in JavaScript. It's not a thing. It is a node. It's not in the browser. But that's okay, because you can still write your front end code that way and then send it through Browserify and have it do its stuff. Fine, right? But the whole world, I feel like, and maybe this is an exaggeration, but it's moved away from the require statement kind of thing. The future has been declared and decided. We're not using require for the browser stuff anymore. We're using import statements. Mm-hmm. ES6 imports. Browserify doesn't do ES6 imports. Webpack does. So that's the deal. So it's kind of like, if you, and then the theory being like, I don't know, this is where JavaScript is heading. It's been declared. It even works in the browser without any of these build tools, if you want it to, although the chances of that happening are pretty low, but maybe in some circumstances someday. So, okay, the world's using, you know, import foo from bar or whatever now, and Webpack's fantastic at that. So, you know, every tutorial you read, you know, I don't know, it's helpful to go that way a little bit. The other thing is here, like, some people are like, why would I work in WordPress or something? Well, then you probably don't need it at all. Or I know that might be an exaggeration, or I have three scripts, I've hand wrote them, I need to squish them all together and make my own bundle. That was kind of like the world we lived in with Grunt and Gulp, right? You'd configure Gulp to say all the like scripts in this folder, or maybe even these three specific scripts, I want you to concatenate them for me and minify them for me. Thanks, Gulp, for doing that for me. But I had to kind of hand configure my Gulp file to do that. I had to tell it what to do. I had to kind of hand configure that. And that's cool and fine too. If that works for you, I'm sure tons of people are doing that. That really makes intuitive sense to me.
I like it too. I like the jQuery style chaining of things I'm going to do to a file. I like that.
So do I. Totally like it. But it does break down at a certain point. It breaks down at the point where you're working on a project that might have dozens, hundreds of individual JavaScript files because of this brave new world of imports. Now that the world is like, break up all your project into little tiny functions that you export and import into other files. That's like the modern way of building a very JavaScript heavy app, is break them all into modules. I have module everything and use these import statements everywhere. Now, configuring a gulp process to traverse that folder set and figure that all out and stuff, that seems like not so great. The beauty of Webpack is that you don't it does have configuration, and it is made fun of for being weird and difficult to configure, but you aren't configuring like, here's this file, and here's this file, and here's this folder, and here's this. Webpack reads your literal code. Your code is the configuration for what to do. You know what I mean? Like, it literally reads your JavaScript, looks at those import statements, and that's the configuration of what to go and where to follow. It will follow that as deep as your code goes. So that is compelling to me, too, in that I don't really configure that part of, like, in the most basic use case of Webpack, the configuration is the code that I've written. That's all.
Yeah. No, I think, back to, like, if it seems useful, I think if you do a lot of, like, NPM install everything, you just have, like, a giant NPM modules folder, and you're requiring those for your front-end work, or if you're, especially, you should probably just go ahead and use this new import syntax. I think that's kind of the, like you said, that's maybe the use case for Webpack. Like, let's you can head in that direction. That, you know,
plus you go Webpack, you get the hot reloading, the module stuff. It's just, it all feels very nice.
And Webpack 2, I hear, is good. Is that the new?
Isn't it 3 now? Is 3 out?
Oh, 3's coming out. Yeah. And so it's, you know, the documentation has gotten better. The developer, Sean Larkin, is the main developer, is now working for Microsoft. And so now he has a little more time and financial support to work on Webpack. So I think it's in good shape. A lot of people use it. I just unfortunately am not one of those people at this. It's not my, like, I don't like the, you know, JSON config style minifiers. So that's me. I'm Dave Rupert. Quote me on your blog. It's not my favorite. Not my favorite way to manage file, like concat minification. But it also does, you know, code splitting. And do I want to figure that out? I maybe do. But do I want to on like a 100 view app? You know, no, I don't.
Yeah, that's tough stuff too, because that's related to routing, and routing is one of our favorite topics. Very complicated. Right. Let's do another one.
Seth Rensha writes in, what ideas can you share with a dad to help teach his kid CSS? She is 11, going into her year before high school in Australia. Loves PowerPoint, the color and design of it. I've done similar stuff with her, gone through CodePen looking for examples. Want to keep it simple, leaving JavaScript out of it though. Thoughts?
I love it. I mean, if she's exhibiting a strong love for PowerPoint, I would encourage that. I'd say maybe keep letting her do that too. You know, I don't know. I'm only working on being a dad. Dad's the real dad here. I'll be dad before the year's out, but I can't tell you what to do with your 11-year-old. Thank you. But it feels like forcing to be like, get rid of the PowerPoint, you know, move over to this thing I like, might backfire a little bit. Just let her use PowerPoint if she likes to use PowerPoint, or maybe use that as a metaphor to start with, because there's certainly things you can do in PowerPoint, like master slides or whatever. That's like, look, what if you wanted to change lobster font to bleeding cowboy font? You only have to change it in this one place, and then it's changed throughout your entire presentation. Like, doesn't that seem like the way to go here? Like, can you, like, you have a 20 slide PowerPoint going here. Changing something in 20 slides seems like too much work. You know, you'd be able to experiment so much quicker if you embraced this master slide concept. And then if that works, if that little like dad trickery seems to land, then you could be like, that's actually the foundation of CSS. You know, that's the whole point of it, is that you have this thing over here where you can control stuff that changes everything over here.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's a handful of properties that give you the instant gratification and power of CSS. You know, you could just spit out some text or something on a code pen, and then just be like, here's font family, and this will change everything. Or here's font size, here's background color, you know, here's color, the like text color, here's text alignment, you know, or is that what it, text alignment? Yes.
Is text align? Text align. Yeah, that's the one.
Text align. Text align. Been making websites
for like 25 years. Align, but then there's like text align. There's some different ones. There's one that stretches things. Anyway, text align.
But there's like a grip of properties that give you the instant, oh man, this is fun, you know? And then here's a, then show your daughter, sugarcoat it with a few transitions, and blam, blam, you got a coder for life.
Yeah, do animation. Oh, that would be, that's the way to go. Because you can probably do some of that in PowerPoint as well, but maybe not, you know, or maybe not even as easy as CSS. Oh, yeah. Throw some animations in there. Get some stuff spinning around for sure.
So I did that thing where you code your own PowerPoint in HTML. Mm-hmm. Use CodePen projects is really great. But the it was fun because I made some of the PowerPoint animations, like a transition, fade in. You go 0% opacity to 100%. Like you could do the keyframes or just kind of build out a keyframes, like, and then, you know, then you do like pop or like slide up, fly in, you know, you can kind of like come up with these animations with pretty simple CSS. You know, you may have to coach your daughter on like the actual syntax just because, like, you know, whatever scale X,
yeah,
zero deg or whatever is not very intuitive, but you know, I think like you can, you know, you teach the kind of grip of basics that give like these like really gratifying changes, fonts, colors, and stuff like that, and then, you know, show the kind of magic for like transitions, like fade something in or make something
pop. I wonder if it's the kind of kid that enjoys feeling like she's doing adult-like things. Because that always appealed to me. You could be like, highly paid adults do this. You're doing the same thing that highly paid adults are doing. I don't know how you like bring that up exactly, but DevTools might be a way to do it. Like, hey, what's your favorite website? You know, this website was built with CSS2, and we can just pop open DevTools and take a look at it and change stuff and play around. Like, check that out.
Oh, man, that's drugs. Going like just Chris, we actually almost this show. You could tell your daughter she could grow up to host a podcast. There you go. But we started this show because I think we were having beverages at a conference and we had this idea where it called CSS Riffin. Do you remember CSS Riffin?
Oh, I totally remember it. And in fact, somebody like pitched me a similar idea recently. Like, I met somebody else who was like, what if we have, like, a DevTools show where we just, like, mess with other people's website? I'm like, oh, dude, episode one is already available.
Yeah. Just the outline of the show was have a few beverages and then just start messing around with your friend's website and record it. You get, like, 8 minutes or something to just do whatever you want to somebody's website. That's great. That's fun times. Make it fun.
Mm-hmm. Hosted by an 11-year-old Australian girl. Even better.
Even better if she's just ripping the Shop Talk Show site. just totally. Oh, beautiful. I think there's a lot to do here. You can kind of leave JavaScript for a while, you know, if you want. But, you know, there may be things, you know, you want to teach her about JavaScript, you know, variables, for loops, you know, what an array is. Those would be like the first, you know, three or four principles. So,
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, right. Hopefully that helps you.
I heard you laid some Cat 5 cable out to the shed.
Oh, do I sound faster? Because I am hella fast.
Do I sound faster? I feel faster.
Do I sound faster? Because I'm running at 975 megabits per second, Chris. Dude, Chris, I paid a guy, a really nice guy, George. He came out with his wife, Alpha, and they ran. Alpha, yep.
Oh, that's on the name list.
I was like, this is a good name because you could name your kids Alpha, Beta, down all the way down to Omicron. And I have a cable. They punched out. We like removed an old coaxial cable and like ran down. It goes under my deck. The cable's an outdoor graded, you know, Ethernet cable. Goes into my shed. He ran it under some beautifully under some like siding on my shed, and then like went up like just one piece of siding, and then punched it diagonally in. So like he only had to do a little bit, and now I have a cable in my office, and it actually, it goes out to an Eero, which can act as a bridge, and then I go out from the, so that gives me Wi-Fi, the same Wi-Fi as my house, in my office, and then I, like, punch it into my computer box, and I'm going so fast. It's amazing.
Oh, I see. So you put a router out there, too, but then you went right into the computer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's a little Wi-Fi box, but it's the same because it's one of those mesh network routers, like the Eero or the Google Wi-Fi thing. It's the same network inside and outside, so I don't have to like switch networks or whatever on my phone. So it's the same one, so it's cool.
I would be doing this right now. Like I'm selling my house in Milwaukee here in the next month or so, but if I wasn't, I would do it. I'd have to come up a few flights of stairs, but I would hire Alpha to come out and blast up a cable all the way, because I don't have it right now, and I feel like it definitely isn't as good as it could be. And people talk about it, it's not the speed of your network that's the band, or, you know, like 802.11g or whatever is like fast enough that it's not that, it's something else that's the bottleneck, really. But I still think occasionally there's problems with there's benefits to be had for plugging in like you are, especially if you're going through three floors like I am, or the wall of your house and the wall of your shed.
Yeah, like in the concrete tiles for my kitchen that my wife picked up. So, I had like basically like the, you know, drywall in America specifically, or even just like the outer coating of your house usually has some kind of reflective material, like kind of like a mesh, like chicken wire-y kind of thing. So your house is like a Faraday cage. So breaking out of your house or kind of going through walls or whatever is really hard for Wi-Fi, and even good Wi-Fi. So I just having a wire is cool.
I'm going to do it. My new office, whatever it has to be. I think it's good. I just invested in this microphone and stuff. It's like little investments like that, that take you up another level in your job and ability to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I have fiber in the house, and that's like, a godsend. Like fiber is really cool. But I was not getting fiber in the office, but that's fine. But the big thing was I was getting inconsistency, you know, and I think that like I can have 10 megabits a second if it's consistent. Does that,
right?
That's like, but if it's like dropping out at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday or something, that's like nails on a chalkboard. It's just so frustrating. So I just, you know, I think it's all about having good, consistent Wi-Fi. You know, you go to a coffee shop, you know, it's fine until like somebody like starts FaceTiming their cousin, you know, in the coffee shop, and you're like, everything's bad now. I think I like this was my like lifelong mission, and I think I've solved it until like inevitably I move. So there.
Yeah, but you learn. Now you know how to do it right next time.
Yep. And I got old George and Alpha to back me up next time I need to do it. So
there's something bugging. Chris Rosenberry writes in, I'm hoping to get your thoughts on something that's been bugging me. 15 years ago, I fell hard into building websites with Flash. I loved the animation, the ability to place elements wherever I wanted. I even loved the loading animations. Now I'm feeling like I'm having deja vu. So many sites look like they come from the same Flash family tree. Truthfully, I'm not sure how to feel about this. Is this just history repeating itself? Have we not learned the mistakes from our past? Or has CSS and JavaScript animation really improved this method that much? I don't know. Like, I wonder what websites Chris is looking at that feel like they could be Flash sites. I mean, I don't feel like I see that often.
Timely question, because Flash was EOL'd recently. Mm-hmm. And 2020, it will no longer be updated, I believe. And so that's great.
It was a weird news story, because I'm like, isn't that not already happened? Is that a new thing?
But I think it's a big deal. For enterprise-y sort of
things. I'm sure stuff. There's a secret underground world that half the world still uses Flash, and it's just outside of my circles a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So is history repeating itself? I think so, but you know, there is a thing where people want the effect, the classic Flash effect, where this whole site fades in fully rendered.
Sure.
Right.
I don't know if this is breaking some rule or anything here, but Chris wrote in from his I think he works at a place called Fifth Story Interactive. And I was just like, oh, let me go check it out. Totally has that, you know, that look, that spinner. Then the whole site pops in and it feels like it could have been made in Flash for sure. So,
yeah, I mean, that's, I think, like, you know, Active Theory is another,
yeah,
like really heavy JS, you know, they get a lot of awards. I think it's something that's happening. I think, you know, you could take the Google advice of progressive rendering, where, you know, you try to paint and load and time to interactive as fast as you humanly possibly can. But then when you do client work, there's this big demand to kind of have this beautiful experience kind of appear from the ether. And that's been going on since forever. So, it's, you know, and the thing with any kind of JS framework, React, Vue, whatever, unless you've done all the work to do server-side rendering, you have to, you know, call the HTML document, which is like a blank empty body tag or empty app ID, and then you have to load in JavaScript. Wait for all the JavaScript to load, wait for it to parse and then execute, and then it can start painting your page. You know, and that takes time. That takes a lot of milliseconds. That takes a lot of milliseconds on a, you know, on a phone, on a bad phone, on a 3G device. So statically generated sites can also have this problem. They can also insert render blocking JavaScript, and they can also, you know, mess up CSS in a way that it's like blocking. But you can also, I guess, you know, if you're pretty confident your CSS is going to load, you can really cheaply do like a nice fade in animation using like CSS. So you can just display none and then on in line and or something, and then like animate important or something. Or so,
yeah, I don't see that tons of often, but you're right. Maybe it's happening more and more. I'm just trying to feel like what I think about this. I don't know. I didn't live the Flash days hard enough to know, I guess, but it really doesn't seem like another thing I think of as Flash is a little bit like SVG in a way. And that it's this like hard fixed aspect ratio thing that you place things in that scales all together if it scales at all.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't super responsive, but you could make it like a full bleed thing, like a full bleed movie, and then it would be like SVG. Mm-hmm. So any overflow would be visible.
It's funny, and also that so much of it came down as one SWF file, and there's also some kind of like I think like, wouldn't it be nice if websites arrived as one file that instead of 30 files, that, you know, because there's problems with latency and all that stuff. Like, if you could bundle one thing, that would be cool, especially if one thing, if it wasn't every pixel of everywhere, but it was one file that would render all of itself. And then as it needed more stuff, it could continue to ask for more stuff from the network. But the initial thing was just one file. That seems rather Flash-like as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, what's interesting about Flash was the files were called movies. You know, you made a Flash movie, you exported a movie. And I think that's true about websites now. Your website can either be a movie that you want people to sit and watch as it like fades in. It can be a PowerPoint where you're only showing them one thing at a time and they have, you know, like you're scroll hijacking, or it can be a website, like a document. So, I mean, those are your three things. It can be an app too, I guess, but that just means you have a form on there.
It's funny. I'm doing this talk about, I have to do this talk about my life or whatever, and thinking back on these old things. And there was Flash in my college days, but we didn't do a lot of it. And we focused on Director much more, which is very related because there's Macromedia Director and Macromedia Flash at the time. And they shared a ton of DNA, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They're like weird competitors.
Yeah, well, they're, yeah.
Sibling competitors.
Sibling competitors. But they were based on that timeline, you know, with the frames and the dots and stuff. So I feel like I lived it a little bit because I had to do a lot of stuff in Director. But the output of Director was like a CD, kind of. It was, you know, was meant to be played in that way, not it had nothing to do with the web.
I'm trying. I'm gonna look on. I think Paravel has a Flash Easter egg on our website, but I forget where it is. So we used to do a lot of Flash work, and then it got to the point where I did not like doing Flash work, and I was just like, "So if you want me to open Flash, it'll cost $2,000," and I just to open it, and I just was like, "But you know, that never pans out when you like make these whatever."
Yeah. You already hate it. The proper way is to be like, we're just going to transition away from being that type of shop.
Yeah. Yeah. You just say, you know what? We're not doing this anymore. So, I do not know where this thing is, and I'm very curious now.
Well, you can keep looking. I'll read the next question.
Okay, go ahead.
Alexander Fletcher writes in, how do you divide up CSS style sheets during development? I'm making a personal website and thought it would be useful to have separate CSS file, for example, just for the heading and the nav bar so that I could mess around with ideas easier. Is this an anti-practice, or is it similar to other forms of software dev you know of, where like a new class is needed? It's, you know, you've stumbled onto something fascinating here, Alexander. I'd say that... In a sense, if you're doing the, you know, earlier we were talking about like a gulp build kind of thing or something. And Dave and I have even talked about how that was one of the more useful things that SAS did, was it during its pre-processing step, it handled imports for you and squished everything together. And that it was such a valuable thing for so long. And what that allowed you to do is say, you can break up CSS however the heck you want. You like having different sections of your, like your heading nav bar to be a separate CSS file, fine, do it. Your footer could be a different one. You could have a layout one. You could have a typography one. You could, however you want to break it apart that makes sense to you, fine, do it, because it all gets squished together in the end anyway. Who cares? You know, follow your brain. You probably would not have different link tags in your HTML that link to all those individual SCSS files. That's a bad practice, almost certainly. Like, nobody's ever advocated for that. It's changing a little bit in HTTP2, and that maybe we've decided that's not so bad, and we can even occasionally leverage the render blocking nature of link tags in HTML to say, hey, like, you know, this is going to block for a second while it grabs this little tiny piece of CSS that's faster now because of HTTP2, and then, you know, then the HTML for that chunk is right after it in the HTML, and by the time it gets to that HTML, it already has the styles it needs to lay out that HTML. It's kind of clever and interesting. I haven't seen a lot of people doing that yet, but it feels like maybe we'll go there, in which case we aren't smashing our CSS together. We're leaving them separate. I don't know what the future of that is.
I was going to say, if you're messing around with heading navbar stuff, like things at the top of your website, hey, why not just inline that like critical CSS style? And, you know, I mean, you can spit out a file and then have PHP or Jekyll or whatever include that file like in the header.
Right. Development wise, it's still a separate file, probably.
Yeah. Development wise, you probably want an artifact out there so you can like investigate what's going on when it goes bad. But yeah, like start inlining that. So when you get, you know, you're bloating your, you know, first your pages, every single page, but you get an instant first paint, you know, especially if you're doing that. It's, you know, and it's maybe weird that your, you know, global.css file does not have the heading nav bar, but you know that every page has it in there. So that could be a, pretty cool trick for you.
We also talked about Webpack a bunch, and we talked about the way that Webpack works is that it reads your code to follow the dependency tree and figure out what's going on in there. That's true for CSS as well. So Webpack can be taught about any language really and how to deal with it. So a lot of people, if they're going down the Webpack tree, don't just use it for their JavaScript stuff, but use it for CSS as well and all kinds of stuff. So it's fancy. You can teach it about SVG as well. And it's pretty wild.
Yeah. The thing is like, like you could come up with like fun, you know, ways to split this up. It's really tough to test though. You gotta, you know, it's like days of testing to find the optimal situation that kind of works across a handful of templates and stuff. But I think do it, you know, experiment on your own site first before you propose it to a client or a
I'll tell you, I do break stuff up like that. I very regularly will make like a headers.scss file and a, you know, main nav.scss file. I still break stuff up like that is my kind of my go-to way of being. Well,
so footer or I jumped my brain. So Chrome just changed the way it kind of parses CSS and stuff like that. So you can have a link tag inside your body tag. And when the browser kind of scrolls down and is reading the document and it hits the link tag, it'll stop rendering, but it'll render everything above that link tag. So if you think about like you just before your footer, you put a link href footer.css like on the top of your footer, your browser will like go through, render the whole page. When it gets to the footer, it's like, oh, I got to bail out, go get this thing. But I'm not going to render this footer till later until I get the CSS. And then it grabs the CSS and then it says, okay, I can render what's below here.
Right.
That's actually great because your user doesn't need the footer instantly. You know, the it's still in the document, but they don't need it.
That's what I mean. You're like kind of it can leveraging the render blocking nature of it a little bit, which changes. It's going to change the way we think about how we're going to approach all this.
Yeah, because you think about a blog, you know, you'd basically have inline your header CSS or whatever, and then maybe there's the first link tag is your article list or your article CSS, and then it'll block that. And then it grabs that little file. It's probably going to be a very little file. And then it'll render the article list. And then it's going to go and be like, okay, I need to get comments CSS. Okay, I got comments CSS. I'm going to render comments CSS. And then I'm further down the document. Okay, I need to get sidebar CSS. Cool, I'll block this. And then I'll render the sidebar CSS. And then I need to come down and I got footer CSS. Okay, I'm going to block that, render footer CSS. Edge, that behavior is already in Edge, that kind of progressive rendering that we were talking about. So it's something to think about. And I think it's like, again, like the stepping stone to web components. You know, you have a footer component that has all the footer CSS inside of it. You have an article component with all the the content inside of it. I think we're in a really cool place for progressive rendering and modularity.
Absolutely. So, Alexander, yes, I think a lot of this is leaning towards, yes, you should have separate CSS files for those things. Whether you're doing it with SAS, whether you're doing it with Webpack, whether you're going to leverage this new world of render blocking fanciness and stuff, all that is headed towards splitting up your files.
The only negative is if you're on HTTP1, it could be kind of slow. But if you're on HTTP2, like you should do this sort of, right? That's kind of my feeling.
I think it needs to shake out a little further, a little bit more data wouldn't hurt, but yeah, I think so.
Wow.
So here's another situation about splitting up CSS. I got a hypothetical for you that we can wrap up with, I think.
All right. Hit me with a hype.
Yeah, it just was a thing and that came up in CSS the other day. Let's say you're releasing a new feature for your app and it requires to change up something like,
okay, answer, burn down the whole site, rebuild the whole site. I'm done. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Refactor.
The
oh my God.
That's it's now done. React.
Well, it's too soon. Okay. Alexander mentioned a heading or a nav bar, right? Let's say you're going to roll out this new feature to 10% of your user base because it's an experimental new feature. And so you need, but it requires a change to your header. Mm-hmm. So how exactly, like, are you going to rip all the header CSS out of your global and out of your critical or whatever you're doing? And that way, you know, for 10% of the people, you're going to ship them a new header style sheet. And for the other 90%, they're going to get another partial, but it's based on the old CSS. You had to take it out of that efficient concatenation system because it's weird. Or you could say, okay, for the 10% of people that are getting the new header, I'm just going to ship them an additional, I'm going to leave the global the way it is and ship them an additional style sheet that through specificity in the CSS overrides all that old stuff. Mm-hmm. That would be another way to approach it, which feels a little weird because now you're shipping more CSS than you need kind of thing. And you're shipping CSS that is artificially powerful. So that means that when you decide that you're going to roll this out to everybody, now you need to, you have a bunch of steps to do. You have to go back into the global and pull out all the old stuff. You have to put in the new stuff, but the new stuff has been artificially specificity up. So you have to remove all that because you don't want to like start a war with yourself over time. So it's kind of this complicated scenario. If like you want to like AB shoot some CSS, there's no like, I feel like there's not like an amazing answer for that.
Man, are you in my Slack chat right now? Because I am doing this very thing with like a header, and you know, and the header is sort of determines what else we can do. You know, like you know, it, will this kind of redesign realignment kind of succeed? But the header's different enough than the current header that it's a whole new HTML, whole new CSS. So what we've kind of settled on is you have to, you know, kind of namespace that test CSS, you know, like it has to be like new, you know, header CSS or something like that. So you need some kind of like namespace to code fence all the CSS you're putting in there, which could be a lot if you're thinking like a header and a, but you end up delivering two, especially if you're doing client side testing, you know, the template rendered one and then the injected one. So you have the template rendered HTML and then the injected HTML. It's, you know, it's less than ideal, I think, but that's why I have a lot of skepticism about A/B testing tools because of this. Server side A/B testing would be way better, but that's quite a bit of effort unless you have a really good tooling system built in, you know? So these client side A/B testing, you know, you have it's called the observer effect from like physics and stuff like that. So like the tools you're using to observe changes are affecting the test itself. So yeah, like our new header will be faster. It'll have lots of, you know, dramatic reduction in CSS. You know, it could have inline critical CSS, but for the test, it will not because it's basically a client side injection. So
I'm not doing client side injection. I mean, for an A/B test, I could see doing it, but this is like a feature. I can't have a feature be like, here's the old header. Oh, here's the new header. It popped in.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah. No.
That would be HTML and CSS in a way. And this is, which doesn't work because it's both for us.
Are you using like Vanity or something like that?
We have A/B testing stuff built in to CodePen as a gem that it works great.
Okay.
So we can do whatever that way. But this isn't an A/B test. This is a literal.
It's a new feature.
Yeah, I mean, kind of.
And so. Yeah. And are you rolling it out to like a beta?
We have a flag, so on server side we can say, yeah, like at first we'll probably just handpick people or whatever, and then we'll roll it out programmatically somehow. And I don't know how we're a ways from having the whole world see this, but we have a server side flag we can use for it. So, but it's like that helps to some degree. But like I said, it's like what's the best way to do it here? And I think we're landing on the, you know, ship a different set of HTML to these 10% or like, let's just say, and then also ship an additional mini style sheet that overrides global. So like immediately it looks like the new version for that 10%. And then just know that we like the going live requires some work. It's not just a matter of just ripping out the old. It's like rip out the old, put in the new, get rid of the linking up of the new and reduce the specificity. So the increasing of specificity, mm-hmm. I might just put an ID on the parent and then just like through SAS nesting, just write everything within that ID. So everything is just like bumped up specificity a bunch. And then I can just remove that wrapper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that. It just seems like that's like this, a nice server side way of handling this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you do kind of have to, you like, run the test, it wins or whatever, and then you have to kind of go through and manicure it and make it a official.
And I think it's like, reasonable that we are trying to avoid the manicuring. Like, I don't want to. I want it to just be when we're done, we just ship it, you know, but that's never that easy, is it?
Never, because you get collisions and, yeah, I don't. This is where, again, web components, I think, are the future, because then you'd just be, like, you're changing a nav or something. You just say, hey, you get the new web component.
Hey, that's a good point.
Header 2. HTML or whatever.
Good point.
Well, maybe one day I'll ship a site with web components, but you know, today's not that day, Chris. I think we're going to finish it up here. Thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month, and hopefully you and your company got it into the fire sale for advertisements. You could have found out about it there. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Lots of companies want to hire people like you. And I have a lot of people asking me about remote work. There's some remote jobs on that job board. So be sure to check those out. Just apply. Just put your name in the hat. They don't know you. So put your name in the hat. Tell them Shop Talk Show sent you. So, all right. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, I think that'll do it, folks. ShopTalkShow.com.